I'm Hubert Fala, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this morning is Robert Audy, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and we're going to be discussing separation of church and state. Robert, glad to have you on the show.
Delighted to be here to talk with you.
To give the listener a bit of a background, you just recently finished a book in which you discuss the issue of separation of church and state.
Yes, Religion in the Public Square, the Place of Religious Convictions in Political Debate, done jointly with Nicholas Walterstorff of the Yale Divinity School.
Okay, and though it's jointly authored, it's not as if you've both written the book together, correct?
Right, each of us does a long essay, each does a commentary on the other, and I have a concluding postscript.
Okay, and I should also mention to the listener that Professor Walterstorff will be a guest on next week's show. What I'd like to do in the book, in your contribution, you defend the idea of separation of church and state, and you think that that has implications for both what the state should do, what individual citizens should do, and what churches should do. I'd like to begin by briefly discussing what you see as how the idea of separation of church and state works out in terms of the way the state should behave, what the state should do.
Let's start with the idea that a free and democratic society particularly wants to protect religious liberty. Let's also note that it's very appropriate for religious people to try to realize their ideals in day-to-day life, including their life as citizens. I think the genius of a free democracy is to provide a climate and a structure within which individuals can realize religious ideals and yet respect the liberties of others, including the non-religious. So as is well known, the Constitution provides for separation of church and state and for religious liberty. I explore this not only in terms of institutions, government above all, but at the level of individual citizenship. Now maybe I ought to mention three principles I propose at the institutional level, principles of separation of church and state. First, a libertarian principle to the effect that the state should permit, within certain limits, the exercise of religion, whatever it be. Now, those limits would include, for instance, the sacrifice of human beings. We needn't permit that. There's also, however, a need for equal treatment of different religious groups. And so I have an equalitarian principle calling for that. We don't want preference given to a majority religion, for instance, and if we do give that kind of preference, pretty soon minority religious groups will find their liberties restricted or at least their opportunities curtailed. Now, a more difficult issue is whether the state should be neutral with respect to religion, for instance, not promoting religious institutions or practices over non-religious ones. You could be even-handed in not preferring one religion over another in principle, even if you preferred the religious to the non-religious. My suggestion is that we will not preserve religious liberty adequately if we don't have state neutrality toward religion. Otherwise, there will be criteria for what counts as religious. Those criteria will tend to be dominated by certain religious views, and we may end up violating the equalitarian principle in addition to abridging rights or at least opportunities of non-religious citizens.
Okay, say more about that, because I'm sure to some of our listeners that view might seem to be very foreign. On the one hand, you're wanting to say that the aim of your principles is to defend religious liberty, but that one of the consequences of trying to defend religious liberty is that individuals or the state should be neutral between religion and non-religion. And again, I can imagine some listeners finding that view very odd. So could you say more about why that's true?
Mention two sides of the issue. First of all, neutrality does not imply lack of accommodation. It's very reasonable for a democratic government to have religious holidays of a great majority coincide with national holidays. So you have a policy that benefits a religious majority, but that is intended as a state policy to benefit the majority of citizens. There are many things that can be done that actually benefit the religious and the non-religious alike, but benefit the religious differentially. So neutrality does not undermine a number of practices that are perfectly reasonable and part of the fabric of our democracy. On the other hand, suppose we don't have a neutrality principle and we go to something like conscientious objector status. What if that were granted only on religious grounds rather than on deeply held, long-standing grounds of conscience? That, I think, would be an objectionable kind of non-neutrality. So there's a case where the non-religious would actually suffer in ways that I think are not appropriate to a free democracy.
Well, in fact, that's a good example, because originally conscientious objector status was given to people, only people who were religious. That is, the grounds given had to be religious, correct?
I think that's right.
And what the courts held is that if you're going to allow people to choose alternative service rather than being in the military on religious grounds, that you also had to allow it on deeply held moral grounds.
I think we've made progress on that matter.
Okay. Now, I'd like to turn, though, in a somewhat different direction to your comments about what all this means for individuals. That is, you're not just concerned about what it means for the state, but what it means for individuals. Maybe you could begin by giving an overall picture of what your view is, and then we can go back and look at each of the elements of it in some detail.
Right. I think that a number of the reasons for having separation of church and state at the institutional level support a measure of separation of religious and political considerations at the individual level, for instance, in one's conduct as a citizen. Now, the word separation can be a little bit misleading, because what I call for is a distinction between religious considerations and secular ones, and I call for according each an appropriate role, never denying the significance of either kind of reason. But let's just take an example that we can work with. Try to imagine that one religious group, which becomes a majority, favors a practice that minority religious groups oppose, and the non-religious may divide in opposing or favoring it, as the case may be. We don't want in a free democracy for any view that is favored by a religious majority just on that count to be instituted legally and backed perhaps by punishments. And there are also abridgments of rights that can occur that are less conspicuous than the kind of thing I'm imagining. There are various practices in public health, various practices in education, including prayer in the public schools, that come to mind. And notice that if prayer is mandatory in public schools, there will be the question of who composes the prayer. And there will be objections to any committee that could be formed. The state, of course, cannot institute a religion of its own and prepare an appropriate prayer. So here is a well-known example that illustrates the need both for separation of church and state at the institutional level and for a distinction between religious and political considerations at the level of citizenship. I think that you and I as individual citizens should not support practices that are alienating to religious minorities or the non-religious, certainly not in the public school. That's by way of general background.
Well, actually, I'd like to maybe pursue that issue, because that's an issue, again, in the area, at least of the listening audience, that's dear to the hearts of many people. A number of people would think that, look longingly on the days in which there was mandatory prayer in schools. And I take it that you think that that's both an inappropriate public policy and that it would be inappropriate for a civic-minded religious person to support. Could you just say a little bit more about that, about why that's so?
Let me be very clear that I think that prayer at any time for those who can meaningfully do it is positive. And the point is that we don't want to mandate periods in which a short, or for that matter, a long worship service is given in public schools. We could, of course, have periods set aside for prayer with no one praying aloud. But of course, this would tend to make the non-religious feel excluded, and that in itself is a problem, and it seems to me not a good thing to have happening in the public schools. We could have a period set aside for meditation, which everyone would understand is, for many people, a period for prayer. That's a different matter altogether, and I don't really see that there's any great problem about that. It may not be good to use school time, which is already too short for it, but my principles do not preclude a period of meditation. There are risks, because if it's mandatory, some may feel that they're being pressured to pray or to feel guilty if they don't. If it's not mandatory, those who don't go may be discriminated against. So prudence may dictate that we not do this, but my principles don't prohibit it. Now, maybe I ought to say something about what principles I have in mind here. I suggest that citizens in their political life abide by a principle of secular rationale. This principle posits a prima facie, not an absolute, but a prima facie obligation not to support, for instance, to advocate or vote for laws that restrict human freedom without having adequate secular reason. Now, one is only being asked by this principle to have adequate secular reason. One is not being told that religious reasons don't matter or should be ignored. One is not even being told that they aren't the most important kind of reason. The overall idea here is that if one proposes restrictive legislation, for instance, legislation to prohibit assisted suicide, and has adequate secular reason, then any citizen who disagrees, whether on secular or religious grounds, can be given an argument which appeals to human reason, something we all have in common, something fundamental in the basis of working democracy. So it's a moderate principle, but it would serve to prevent many kinds of polarization, and it provides one common dimension of discourse for us all, however we may differ in what we bring to the discourse otherwise.
Okay. I want to pursue that in the second half of the show, but I'd like to briefly stop here and reintroduce you for anyone who may be tuning in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Robert Audy, professor of philosophy at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and we're discussing separation of church and state. Now, there are a number of questions I want to ask you about this principle of secular rationale. When you say it's secular principles, could you say more about what that might mean?
Well, a secular reason is one whose evidential force, whose justificatory power, does not depend on appeals to God or on theological appeals. Interestingly enough, such a principle allows another kind of dependence on God, a dependence on God for one's very existence. So this is not in any sense an anti-religious principle. It says don't be dependent on religious ideas or inspiration totally in proposing legislation that would restrict human behavior, as most legislation does. I ought to say, if someone gives us a grant to decorate a state highway, and I want sculptures that are religiously significant, well, really, those who drive by don't have to look. It's not like a case of a captive audience. And here, my religious reasons can be appropriate under my principle. But if it's a matter of restricting physician-assisted suicide or a criteria for the draft, that's another matter.
Could you give an example? What would be a case where an individual might have a religious reason that might be part of their own motivation, but they would also have a secular reason,
right,
which on your view would justify
right,
their
actions?
Let's
go back to physician-assisted suicide. Okay. Suppose I believe that life is given by God and should be taken only by God. And I really think physician-assisted suicide is religiously wrong. Well, why shouldn't it also be morally wrong in a world created by God? And if it is, why shouldn't I be able to find a secular reason to oppose it? It seems to me that here my religious convictions might be a ground on which I can build a secular reason, or at least from which I can find one. So perhaps I determine that families will be tempted to dispatch older people too quickly to inherit. The state may be disposed to restrict funds for serious illness, terminal illness generally. And these are secular reasons to resist this practice. There's also the general slippery slope issue. There's the issue of legal hassling when there's disagreement about whether somebody's really terminally ill or might have weeks or months of quality living ahead if nothing is done. So you can have aligned religious and secular reasons. And you can find a secular reason because you started with a religious one. But interestingly, you can also find a religious reason because you started with a secular one. This is a two-way street, as I see it.
Well, now, I can imagine a listener, though, saying, look, I'm religious. Why should I need a secular reason? I believe that physician-assisted suicide is wrong because I think it is in violation of God's commandments. On your view, someone, a civic-minded religious individual can have that sort of reason, but again, it should not be sufficient to justify the policy. Why do they need a secular reason?
It shouldn't be sufficient to justify coercion, but it is sufficient to justify trying to persuade people. And it's very important to see that my principles do not restrict free expression, and they do not in the least discourage religious people from persuading others on whatever grounds they find appropriate to the discussion. It's coercion, the undermining of liberty, that deeply concerns me. And here, I remind everybody of the do unto others rule. How would one like it if another religious group were in the majority and because of its own scripture or theology proposed to vote in legislation that restricts one's behavior in ways one thinks entirely unwise, with prison sentences as sanctions? We all recoil from that prospect.
Now, part of what underlies your idea of the importance of having secular reasons is the belief that human beings not only can, but often do have multiple justifications for what
right.
they do. Could you say a little bit more about that? I think that's an important element here.
Well, I think we're all creatures of reason. I think it's a very reasonable religious view that a great gift, some would say the greatest gift of God, is reason. So this is something we have in common. Moreover, when reason is properly used to justify coercion, as in the case of a public health rationale for inoculation, we don't resent the coercion in the way we resent coercion that seems to us to be the imposition of somebody else's will or of some alien doctrine. So I think that's the sort of thing that speaks for the principle I'm proposing.
Okay.
I might add to that just this. I'm not suggesting that we divide ourselves into our religious persona and our secular persona. Reason belongs to us as religious people and is needed to understand God. So the use of reason is not something anti-religious. And just because where there are deep religious reasons, there often or always are secular reasons. And where there are good secular reasons for restricting behavior, there are commonly or always religious reasons. We can get ourselves into a frame of mind in which there's a fruitful interaction between our religious moral thinking and our secular moral thinking. Think of the Ten Commandments as a case in point. The moral content of the Ten Commandments is reflected in, I think, all the plausible moral systems coming down to us in Western and, I think, in much of Eastern philosophy.
Okay. Now, I take it to the part of what's going on here, too, is that you recognize that individuals may hold moral principles either on religious or on secular grounds, and they may be mistaken about them. And one of the advantages of having multiple reasons in support of your views is that it makes you more confident in your view. So that if you happen to have you're, again, a civic-minded member of a democracy, you have religious reasons for a view, and you also have secular reasons for the view, then you as an individual should be more confident that the view you're endorsing is
Yes, people often wonder why philosophers give more than one argument and more than one reason. Arguments are both pillars of conviction and paths to understanding. And when you have two good reasons, one religious and one secular, for a moral stand, you're both more motivated to promote behavior respecting the standard, and you understand better the grounding of the standard. In fact, as you may remember from looking at the book, I propose that there is a possible theo-ethical equilibrium, a balance between religious and considerations that should be expected given standard Western theism. The idea is roughly this: if God is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good, and has created a world with enough ambiguity so that some people are allowed by God to reject him, then we should at least expect that there are secular paths to moral truths. I don't think we should suppose that God would allow the profound tragedy of those who already reject their creator, on this earth at least, cannot, by the use of reason, even find standards for living in a moral way from a secular point of view. Now, this is theologically controversial, but I think on certain kinds of assumptions in natural theology, it should be expected that we can approach a theoethical equilibrium. The effect of that idea is to caution one about the fallibility you just referred to. If you've got a deep conviction about how society ought to operate from religious premises, and you can't find a good secular argument, that should be disturbing. And for a religious person, it should be disturbing if there is no religious grounding or context for a secular position about how we ought to live in society.
Okay. I want to shift now a little bit. We've been talking about the principle of secular justification, and that's the idea that the reasons we give in favor of policies which will limit other people's liberty ought to include at least some secular reasons which are sufficient. You also, though, want to say something about the motivation that a citizen should have. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the principle of secular motivation. Could you explain what that principle is?
Yes. Imagine someone who really is voting to restrict physician-assisted or other assisted suicide on religious grounds, but knows that some people think, and that it's not unreasonable to think, that there is a possible slippery slope. And sliding down that slope might mean fatal injections for people who ought not to have them. Now, if one offers as a reason for supporting a policy a consideration that does not move one, is not motivating, one is offering a rationalization. Offering a rationalization is, of course, not a crime, but it can smack of insincerity or manipulation. I think that we do best when the reasons we offer for policies, particularly where human freedom is at stake, are reasons we believe in. So I introduced the concept of a civic voice, and the way to see the idea is to think about instruments. Instruments sound very, very different depending on the origin of the sound. Even when the pitch is the same, A440, let's say, coming from a violin, a piano, a French horn. So I suggest that the virtuous citizen will seek not to base coercive practices on reasons that are not motivated. Now, we are naturally motivated by reasons we think are good, but it is possible to have reasons that you think are appropriate, that are persuasive in the abstract, that will move your audience, where you don't believe in those reasons.
Okay. We've got about 3 minutes left. What I'd like to do is to at least touch on the last point you discussed. how the idea of separation of church and state affects or should affect the way that churches or organized religious groups behave. Some religious groups will openly campaign. A minister may, from the pulpit, support a particular candidate or may urge passage of a particular law. What does your principal have to say about those sorts of behaviors?
Well, first, by way of background, let me say that the obligations of citizenship I've been talking about are prima facie not absolute. I've not been saying that there is no moral right to vote on a religious conviction if one simply sees no alternative. But there is an obligation to do better than merely act within one's moral rights. I emphasize responsibilities and the virtues of citizenship, which is why I have a motivation principle, which is a kind of virtue principle, as well as a rationale principle. The rationale principle is the more important. Now, the kinds of things we've been talking about seem to me to carry over to some degree to the context of the behavior of religious institutions. I think that just as the state should not interfere in the church, and I use the term church generically so that it covers non-Christian religions, the church should not interfere in the state, and I believe that it is best for the church and best for democracy if churches are, broadly speaking, politically neutral. I hasten to add that political neutrality is not moral neutrality. It's not easy to say just exactly what the political is in contrast to the moral. But the political has to do with who is going to have power, with what party is going to govern, for instance. And I think that as we find again and again in the Bible, there is a sense that the spiritual mission is first for the church and is full scale, a total commitment. There's no question that morality must be supported and preached. But even if a minister preaches a sermon about dealing with poverty that has implications for public policy, it's one thing to preach morally and let citizens draw their own conclusions, and another to tell them how to vote, what candidate to support, exactly what detailed policy to pursue. So neutrality is favored, I think, by a sense of what the church is really about, as well as by considerations having to do with optimal citizenship in a free democracy.
Okay. In 30 seconds, how would you, if you were going to boil down what you take the lesson to be, the important lesson to be of your view, what would it be?
I don't think I can quite boil it down, but I have certainly been emphasizing that we want religious inspiration to be a positive factor in a free democracy. We also want secular reason to be a clarifying and unifying factor among citizens of different religious backgrounds, and including citizens who do not have a religion. And I think my principles allow people to respect both others, religious and non-religious, and their own religious convictions.
Okay. Thank you very much for appearing on the show.
I enjoyed it.
I've been talking today with Robert Audi, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. This is Eula Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.